Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we are going spelunking with the gracious Dr. Greg Brick. Dr. Brick has worked as a hydrogeologist with environmental consulting firms and at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and he has taught geology at local colleges and universities. He has edited the Journal of Spelean History for the past 20 years. He has published more than 200 articles about caves and was the recipient of the 2005 Cave History Award from the National Speleological Society. He has written 4 books, including his most recent Minnesota Underground, co-authored with Doris Green and released in 2019. He has served as co-editor of Caves and Karst of the Upper Midwest, a textbook covering Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa. His work has been featured in National Geographic Adventure magazine, as well as on the History Channel. He has led guided tours of caves for the Minnesota Historical Society and the University of Minnesota College of Continuing Ed. Today, he is taking us on a subterranean journey into centuries-old caves of Mushroom Valley near St. Paul, Minnesota. Dr. Brick, thank you so much for joining us on the Mushroom Hour.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, and I love the opportunity to interview experts about things that I am fascinated in that aren't necessarily mushrooms. It kind of brings another element to the show. And I mean, caves, the underworld, this is area rife with so much interest for me. So I was really, really honored when you reached out. And to kick us off, you know, how did you become ensconced with the underground? What made you interested in caves and these dark recesses of our planet?
Well, actually, I was told not to do this.
That's a good start.
Yeah, because there are a lot of caves around here. And when I say here, I mean the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul area. Now, Minneapolis, some people might know, hey, that's where George Floyd happened. St. Paul is a neighboring city. That's the capital of Minnesota, for context. Caves were dug for many reasons that I'll get into later, but I was specifically told by my parents and warned not to go in these caves because my brothers would always come back with these hell-raising stories of, you know, what they saw in these caves and you know, people fighting and, you know, like syringes. And, you know, this is in the 1960s. It's like, whoa, this is all like drugs and stuff. And it sounded real dangerous. You know, the age when I think most people around here actually go in these caves and they're teenagers. I mean, I go to book events. And, you know, I have one person after another saying, oh, yeah, I used to love to go in those caves as a kid. Well, I was deprived of that. I didn't get into caves until I became an undergraduate in geology at the University of Minnesota. And the time came to choose some kind of research topic. And, you know, I said I could go work on the microprobe machine, which didn't sound exciting. You know, it was all kinds of lab work. And I just, after a while, I found that that the topic of the caves had not really been well investigated by in a geological sense. And so I kind of took that up as my special area. And I was kind of surprised when, you know, the people around me in the geology department hadn't heard of any of these places. It's like, whoa, I mean, this sounds like I'm onto something now. I have my own kind of little kingdom here where I can have a research topic and do something actually quite interesting. So when I started going in these caves in my 20s, you know, most normal people by that time, you know, they had already given that up. You know, as teen, and went in there and, you know, it was a great place to, you know, roll a keg in there and, you know, enjoy the being away from the prying eyes of parents and the authorities. And, you know, I never got to experience that. So when I got down there, it was kind of a nerdy thing. I didn't look upon it as a place to drink beer, but a place to investigate. And, to, you know, to look at what can this, is my goal, basically. It's kind of like my, one of my things, my rules, you know, never to go into a cave, you know, to waste all that time, as it were, without, to spend all that time without actually making some kind of geological conclusion or discovery in there, absent which it would be kind of a waste of time for me. So to use my time, well, it's like I want to make a geological observation in here. And even if it's an artificial cave, it gives you access to, so like the underbelly of the city, you can, it's like, that's, you know, not otherwise, that you can't get that viewpoint very easily otherwise.
You actually just got into some of the basics that I was hoping you could lay out for us to frame all of this. And, you know, when I read that introduction, speleological, caves and karsts. So when we're in this world of caves, you know, I guess, how do we define it? Are there other crevices in the earth that aren't technically caves? And then, you know, when we think of natural caves or man-made caves, is there any different definition or any different way it's treated in your discipline?
Yeah, well, so a cave is, I guess, the simplest definition. The one I use is that a cave is something that you can fit your body into. Obviously, if you come to like a very narrow crevice that nobody can fit into, even a contortionist, you know, Houdini fitting inside a milk can, then it's not a cave. You know, it's just a crevice or a, you know, macro void or something like that. So you have to be able to actually get in there and explore it. And yes, some people do make this distinction between caves, natural caves, and artificial caves. And they don't want to use the term artificial with regard to, if it's an artificial cave, they want to call it a mine. But that leads to some awkward terminology if you really follow it through consistently. So, for example, it's been for, you know, the longest time, the mushroom caves around here have been called mushroom caves. Now, to call mushroom mines, it's leaving you scratching your head like, what do you mean a mushroom mine? I kind of get it. You know, it's a mine for mushrooms, but you didn't really mean that. And sometimes these caves, I've seen caves, artificial caves around here, they're so old and weathered that it's hard to tell anymore. I mean, it's really hard to tell, is this a natural or artificial void space? And so now you're put in a quandary. Well, I don't know what it is. Well, just, you know, it's easy enough to say natural cave and artificial cave. And so I use the word cave for both of them. And there's a third category right in the middle that is one of the specialties around here, and that is the anthropogenic cave, which means the human-produced cave. You say, well, don't you mean artificial cave? Well, no, what an anthropogenic cave is, a cave that is the inadvertent result of human activities. Like an excellent example of that is a sewer washout. We have caves under Minneapolis of enormous size that are sewer washouts, and they would not be there except for human activities, but no one deliberately dug them out. So that's a third kind of middle category. But with those three, you can pretty much, you know, cover everything in the world.
So anthropogenic is not expressly made by humans for the purpose of creating a void space, but comes as a natural follow through of human activity. That's really interesting. And when we talk about natural cave systems, because, you know, originally I'm from the East Coast, we had visited Luray Caverns, and I've been to my share, really, of probably natural and artificial caves. But when we think about some of these natural caves, what are the forces that create them? What are some of the different forces that create natural cave systems? Because sometimes the beauty and the structure is unreal. So what are some of those forces that create natural cave systems?
I address that. That's largely addressed in my book, Caves and Karsts of the Upper Midwest. But there's a dichotomy initially between The first big break or division is between solutional caves and non-solutional caves. And the solutional caves are by far the largest number of caves in the world. And those are created by groundwater solution. Overwhelmingly, this is simply, you know, this is like rainwater infiltrating in the ground, picking up carbon dioxide in the soil and becoming weakly acidic, and then dissolving out limestone and leaving a cave there.
Right.
And that, the, you know, the largest cave in the world, Mammoth Cave, the one that you mentioned, Luray Caverns, those are good examples of solutional caves. They are by far the largest category here in Minnesota and the upper Midwest also. The other category of natural cave are the non-solutional ones. And these are sometimes called pseudo-karst. So karst refers to the solutional caves. And it's a term from southeastern Europe, which meant a stony place. And it just became applied worldwide to any place that you have a solutional cave. And so if it looks like a cave, but it was not formed by solution, then it will be in this pseudo-karst category. And there's lots of caves, lots of different ones that fall, of a miscellaneous natural caves that fall in that category. For example, lava tubes, you know, there's molten rock, you know, flowing underground, then a crust. Initially the lava's flowing on the surface. If you have a very liquid kind of lava, and then a crust will start to form where it's in contact with the air, but the lava underneath is still hot, so it'll keep flowing. So a roof forms over it, and then it'll keep flowing, and then it'll empty out, and voila, you know, you have a lava tube. And, you know, these are, you know, on the island of Hawaii, there are many lava tubes. There, a lot of them are used for burial chambers, you know, by the natives there. So that's a good example. Let's see, another example of pseudo-karst or a non-solutional cave type would be something like I guess you call it a tectonic cave. This is, you know, if you're hiking along a cliff, frequently you'll see a place where part of the cliff face is starting to split away, you know, and eventually it's going to fall down. But for many years, you know, it can just sit there, and there is a slot-like space there in between the cliff and that piece that's moving outwards.
Yeah.
And that would be an example of a cave, of a pseudo-karst cave, especially if, like, rocks tumble in from the top and then to form a ceiling. Now, those are very unstable. We have those, you know, you go in there and one of those ceiling, or what they call chalk stones, because they just kind of wedge in there. But a lot, it can easily dislodge. And so those are like really kinds of, you know, caves you don't want to mess with. Some other kinds of pseudo-karst. It even includes non-rock material. So caves underneath glaciers, for example. You'll have a tube. Like at the one I saw was at the Mendenhall Glacier in Alaska. And it's just where, you know, this really immensely thick glacier, and then at the bottom, you know, the melt water makes its way down through the glacier down to the bottom there. And then it, you know, it flows as a stream out to the front of the glacier, to the snout of the glacier, and it leaves this nice cave there. And those are found worldwide. Talus caves are another example of pseudo-karst or non-solutional. And those are, again, it's like if you have a whole bunch of rocks tumble down a cliff, a whole bunch of boulders fall down and form what's called talus at the base of the cliff, just that loose accumulation. If you have large enough pieces, you can have spaces to crawl through. And now that seems kind of like a measly sort of caving to do, but there are people who kind of specialize in that. And it's a nightmare to map those kind of caves, because it's like this three-dimensional mess. you know, and imagine trying to map the voids in between, you know, in a pile, go inside a big pile of boulders and try to map that through. It's really awkward. So those are examples of pseudo karst.
I mean, this is fascinating. There's so many questions, but are you partial to any one of these natural types of caves? Is there a certain one formed, whether it's a pseudokarst, whether it's solutional, that you think is particularly like beautiful or usually makes like an incredible cave structure?
Well, obviously you're going to, you know, if you're looking for cave formations and, you know, like at Luray Caverns, you know, the beautiful draperies and stalactites and stalagmites, then definitely you want a solutional cave because that's the only place you're going to find those. But me, a lot of my research has concentrated on sandstone, natural sandstone caves. And these form, and this is a form of pseudokarst. Silica is what sand is made of. It doesn't dissolve very easily in water. So groundwater will flow through there and just kind of wash the grains away, forming a void space. And again, that's a non-solutional kind of cave. And the bulk of my publications have been about those kinds of caves, but they're not well decorated. You don't get fancy formations in them.
I would imagine then you must like crawling in caves, right? I mean, when you were talking about being in a space so tight a contortionist couldn't get through, I was like, oh God, I feel claustrophobic just hearing that. I was like, I would not be able to survive crawling through cave systems. But I guess in your years of research, do you do a lot of that kind of exploratory and mapping work? Is it something you're comfortable with? And even is it something you really love? Do you love diving into sandstone caves and crawling around?
Yeah, no, everyone has their claustrophobic limitations. Right. And it's interesting that even in the caving clubs around here, there are quote unquote claustrophobic cavers. That doesn't make sense, but these are people who will just stick to the big river passages that have a lot of, you know, they're the huge river passages for like mapping and, you know, put on a wetsuit and go in there. They won't go off in the tight little side passages because they don't like. Now I'm used to some pretty tight spaces, but I have my limitations too. When it gets to that point where you have to exhale to push forward, and then you inhale, and then you exhale and push forward. That's where I stop, because it's just, and there are people around here. Probably the most famous cave explorer in Minnesota, John Ackerman, who owns about a square mile of land that he calls the Cave Farm. He has such a tolerance for tight spaces. It's just, he goes in places that I just wouldn't even consider pushing myself into.
It's crazy how you can think about that. And I feel the claustrophobia coming on. Now, where you guys are then, is that a particularly abundant preponderance of caves and karst relative to the rest of the world? Are there just natural cave systems everywhere waiting to be explored, or are they generally kind of centralized? What does that landscape look like?
There's something called the Weary Doctor map of the United States, and this has nothing to do with like a tired physician. There's a guy named Weary, that's his last name, and then there's another guy, his last name is Doctor. It's Dan Doctor, a friend of mine, and they put together the currently most up-to-date map of the karst in the United States. It shows where it's not uniformly distributed at all. I mean, it tends to cluster. The southeastern United States is a big area. You know, tag country, Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia is huge. You know, again, out west, you know, you have, you know, like Carlsbad Caverns and Lechuguilla and so on. The upper Midwest is an area of what we call fluvio-karst. And in a true karst area, like at Mammoth Cave, there's no surface drainage, because as soon as water hits the ground, it goes into a sinkhole and flows in an underground stream. Round here, it's not. It's karst. It's underlain by karst, but the karst is nowhere near as thick. Those limestone layers are nowhere near as thick as they are down in the Mammoth Cave area. And so we have a lot of surface streams and around here. So it's not what you would call fully developed karst, but there are still many, many caves associated with it.
Really interesting. And when we see cave systems, like I'm sure a lot of people have seen online, cave systems in China, or usually it's somewhere in Asia where you see an opening in the earth, and then it kind of goes down to a second world, and there will even be flora growing down there. And I mean, are there areas like that that have some particular, you know, confluence of environmental effects that creates an opening that can then be basically habitable for loads of organisms like that? Is that something unique to that part of the world? Or what's the story with those? Because I'm always so impressed by those cave systems where it seems like there's a second world underground.
Yeah, well, you know, when you were just talking there, I thought of the karst in Borneo, where that is the cave chamber, like the Sarawak chamber, is just like the largest cave room in the world. I mean, these caves are so large that it's hard to tell when you're underground. Like if you're walking, you know, you're just walking into this void space. Mm-hmm. It's hard to tell when you've made the transition because the sunlight and all, you know, it penetrates so far into the cave. It's like, I mean, am I yet in the cave yet? You know, you're kind of looking up for the ceiling. And We don't have that sort of thing here in the United States. Most of the time when you get underground, you go through a series of zones. You go through what's called the entrance zone, and that's where most of, you know, the wildlife is concentrated. Animals like raccoons or bears or something that use the cave for hibernation, bats, that sort of thing, they're going to hang around there. That's where you see them most frequently. And then you get into the dark zone, and that, because there's not much of an energy source in there, except what like floodwaters will bring in, like rotting wood and that kind of thing, for like a fungus to grow on, it's a depauperate zone. There's not much going on there in terms, you know, it's a very spare or sparse ecosystem. So you have to have significant energy inputs to to really have a well-developed underground biota. So you don't get that everywhere.
That's really interesting to think about, you know, the potentiality of organisms living in caves. And that's something that I think harkens back to this archetypal sense when you go in a cave, is like, what is lurking in here? What are we going to uncover? And I did want to dive into that a little bit. And I know this is kind of an odd angle, but, you know, I know this is something kind of off the path of what we've been talking about. Something I've always been interested, though, is that archetypal idea of what caves have symbolized for people, because we're talking about these awe-inspiring natural crevasses in the earth, and we think about, you know, things throughout human time, concepts of the underworld and all of that. So if you've done any research in this area, what's been humans' relationships with caves through time? And, you know, that can be the literal or, you know, the archetypal and figurative or both. But what has that relationship been with humans' relationship with these natural cave systems we're talking about?
Yeah, excellent question. And I talk a lot about that in my book, Minnesota Caves, History and Lore.
That's the right word, lore. Yeah, the
lore. Yeah. See, the thing, it's a spectrum. Caves are, I'll just go through some of them. You know, caves are viewed as places of safety. You know, this is like, a place to hide, a place to get away from the world, like a hermit's retreat, you know. On the other hand, the other extreme, kind of like you touched on it, they can be places of extreme fear. This is a place where you're trapped. A horrible example that is the Sawney Bean Cave in Scotland. They had clan warfare. I mean, just one of many examples, but they had clan warfare going on for a long time. And so one of the clans hid in a cave in Scotland, and the other, you know, the warring clan found them in there and just completely were trapped in there, completely butchered every last one of them. That's an example of a place where a cave is a trap and a death, you know, place of death. I attended a very interesting talk recently by someone from who used to live in the former Yugoslavia. And during World War II, the Nazis would use some of these caves to get rid of people. Some of these caves, I was touring some of these caves in Slovenia. And, you know, you did the deep shafts. I was, you just push them down, just bring them in and just shove them down the shaft. And they just collect at the bottom. They're dead. I mean, they fall hundreds of feet. So it's just now that they're getting around to the forensics of this, removing all the bodies, trying to identify them. I mean, this is like something, happened in World War II when this, dealing with these horrible death pits. So again, that's an example of where a cave is not a place of safety. It's quite the opposite. And then another thing you touched on, caves have many different meanings and allegory, and many. The most famous example, of course, is Plato's cave.
Yes,
the allegory of the cave, and they actually took that out of his dialogues and have published it as a separate book. I mean, it's like, okay, but, so the allegory of the cave, basically here, if you're looking at it, you see shadows on a cave wall. It's kind of like making this, the comparison to human perception. It's kind of like this really imperfect way of perceiving the outside world. There again, there's, an example, or in politics, it's been a metaphor too. I believe every once in a while, you'll hear someone talk about the cave of Adullam. And this is where this is a biblical reference, where all the people, these are like the disenchanted people, when the disgruntled people, like you might say, after a certain person gets elected, you say, I'm moving to Canada. Well, okay, I'm going to the cave of Adullam, this disaffected group of people there. In the Bible, caves are mentioned most frequently as places of burial. Even Jesus was, put in a rock cut tomb. Many Old Testament figures, and that's just because they're, that's not like, hey, we loved it. It's just because there wasn't like a lot of deep soil to bury them in. It was kind of like what you had to do there. So there are whole books, and you mentioned one of them, about the meanings of caves to people. Around here, I think the best example is a cave called the European settlers, is historically known as Carver's Cave, because Jonathan Carver came here in 1766, 10 years before the American Revolution, described this cave, a very early landmark in the upper Midwest. And the Native Americans here call it Wakantipi Cave, which means the house of the Great Spirit. And it's called that for a good reason. Unless you go in there, you really don't know what that name means, because there's a subterranean lake in there. And the water it's 6 feet deep, and so the ceiling is like about, 7 foot. So your head is the only thing sticking up above the water as you go through there. And with water slapping on the walls of the cave and the weird reflections from the light at from the distant entrance, it's really this kind of liminal experience. And I think that's why they called it the House of the Great Spirit, because it's like there are spirits in there. But anyways, there are some Native Americans here who claim that this was... They incorporate this into their origin story. It's well known that the Hopi Indians in southwestern U.S., they said they came out of the ground. They live in kivas and so on. And so there are some who are say there's one tradition, one group of Native Americans here who say that they came out of this cave. So it's like the womb of their nation, so to speak. So I think that's probably the most interesting, what caves mean to people, you know, from right around here.
Yeah, I mean, so many powerful examples in there. And I was just thinking, I mean, what more intimate relationship can we have with, you know, Mother Earth that gives us life and gives us everything than literally going into the earth? And so I'm on one hand, it's amazing to hear all these different uses, both literal and figurative. But on the other hand, it's not surprising how all encompassing it would be. And I did have that question here of, you know, how much is left to be explored, and it spills into a bunch of other, you know, far out there theories of, like, I've heard people talk about civilizations living under the earth, connected in these cave systems, ideas like hollow earth. It's always hard putting these up against an academic who actually knows what they're talking about. But yeah, I guess, is how much in your research, how much is left to be explored when it comes to these natural cave systems? Or I guess you could include artificial. I do want to cover artificial briefly. But how much is left to be explored? And then are things like, you know, civilizations underground, things like that, even feasible, given some of that unexplored territory?
Yeah, well, first I'll address the hollow earth idea, because you only have to take, like, geophysics 101 and it quickly disabuse you, at least of the original Captain Sims version of the hollow earth. That he, you know, what was it, in the 1820s or whatever, he went to Congress to try to get money to go up to the North Pole, and then he would go through a hole at the North Pole and into the earth. You wouldn't even notice. Yeah, it's such a gradual thing. You wouldn't even notice, like in the Borneo karst that I mentioned. You wouldn't even know. Oh, it's like suddenly it's dark, and then you know the earth materials are such that any void space below a few miles, there's so much what we call lithostatic pressure from rock pressure from rocks pushing down on top of each other, that voids, you know, can't exist at very great depth. In fact, the deepest groundwater, and that's not human, that's just water in crevices and stuff, and, you know, just whatever little tiny crevice. Yeah, but meteoric water originating at the Earth's surface has never been found below 6 miles depth for that very reason. It's just because the rock pressure at that point gets so great that the rocks are going to flow and fill up any kind of void space. That's why, you know, I'd already taken geophysics when I, you know, read Descent to the Interior of the Earth, you know, the Jules Verne story, A Journey to the Center of the Earth. And right. It's like, wow, I mean, how are these spaces staying open with that rock pressure? You know, it didn't make any sense to me. It's like, you know, it's just really not possible there. As far as that's, you know, never taken those stories very seriously. But there, as far as what's left to be discovered, I think a great deal in terms of caves underground. That's a famous joke right there. A guy was on a tour at a show cave, which is a cave that you pay to go into, like Luray Caverns, and you know, he naively asked the guide, how much of this cave is above ground? Well, none of it. So I just kind of said to myself, for all the caves that are underground, it's like, well, duh, you know, by definition, they're underground.
Right.
But here in Minnesota, for example, we have about 500 known natural caves, and the largest cave in the state still hasn't been discovered with even that. I mean, even the fact that we have had these cave clubs for decades roaming around looking for caves and on the weekends. And we know that there's a certain place in southern Minnesota where water enters the ground in a sinkhole at a certain point called the York Valley. And then it comes out at a place called Odessa Spring, many miles away. And In those cases, is you know, in every other case where you have that sort of thing, there's a cave in between, or that water is flowing through a cave, and we haven't. So here's the largest spring in the state, Odessa Spring, and we haven't found the cave associated with it yet. And people have tried. They have brought in drill rigs. They have brought in, you know, backhoes, and they still have not been able to get into that. So I think there's, you know, there's a lot more to be done. And I think if that's true of this area, right, you know, right around here, you know, I think it's certainly true of many other places. And the same goes with, you know, with artificial caves. That was one of my things, one of the things that really got me interested. It really encouraged me in cave research back when I was an undergraduate student in geology. There was this cave, rumored cave, under the city of Minneapolis called Schutz Cave. And it's named after a guy called Schutz, but it happens to be spelled so like Schutz and Ladders. You know, so it's like spelled the same way. And you actually need a ladder to get in the cave. But anyway, so it's way down in the sewer system. And people said, that's just a rumor. And that was one of my first great finds. I made my way into that cave. That was in 1989. And this was a complete surprise to, you know, the caving organizations. And this really encouraged me. Hey, maybe I do have something I can contribute here, because no one else is willing to go through these sewers and all this muck and underneath the city to investigate these occurrences. So that's an example of something, you know, that was basically in some sense new. It was something that dated from the way back in the 1800s, about the time of the American Civil War, but you know, no one had been in there. So,
well, and that's something that on our show, in discussing mycology, part of the reason it appeals so much to people is the sense that there is so much left to be explored, so much left to be discovered, that, you know, even the amateur, someone starting off, can make a significant contribution just because something hasn't been tried or something hasn't been looked at. So it's interesting to hear the same with, you know, basically exploring the innards of the earth. And I'm not surprised. So it's fascinating to think how many cave systems are left to be discovered, even if at the same time in understanding it, it has to disabuse me of hollow earth theory. That's okay. There's still plenty to be discovered and plenty to find. But yes, talking about artificial caves, you know, there are a lot of examples that spring to mind for me, but what are some examples of artificial caves? I mean, do subways count? I think of like ancient catacombs that always my imagination runs away with. But when we consider artificial caves, what kind of structures are we talking about?
Yeah, so around here, the majority of these are sandstone caves. So they are dug, so in the Mississippi River Gorge, there are, that's where most of the caves are just, you know, the river is cut down and exposed this sandstone bedrock. And there are natural caves in that sandstone. And it's also kind of like presents this wide open rock outcropping for digging artificial caves. And that's where the majority of them occur. Now, they're used for many purposes. I'll talk about Mushroom Valley in a bit. That's one huge example. But there are also like hundreds of miles of utility tunnels right around here dug in the... There's like under the city of St. Paul, for example, the capital of the state, there's half a dozen levels of utility tunnels dug in this sandstone, and they were dug, you know, they dug, yeah, there's one level for water mains, one level for gas mains, one level for, level for electricity. He said, well, why don't you just put them all in one level? It's like, wait a second, you got to think about this now. You don't want to put an electrical line on the gas level, gas pipe level, because if you have a spark, guess what's going to happen? So that's for those kinds of reasons they separated these things out all these utilities into separate, these separate levels. You mentioned subways. We don't have any subways here, even though they would work quite well. But I lived out on the East Coast for years, and I went exploring. One of my motivations was a book called The Mole People, and it talked about the people who live under New York City and in the subway tunnels. And I wanted to meet these people. I wanted to go down there and well, along with a friend who knew the system better than I did, we went down to the lowest level of Grand Central Station and just jumped off the platform and headed into the darkness.
Wow, and that's brave.
It has subsequently happened. You'll see why. Yes, it was foolishly brave. But the problem was that, ironically enough, the mole people who lived down there must have thought we were transit police, and they would evacuate ahead of us. So you could see like where they had left like some food. Everyone's just left there. It's obvious someone that was there 2 seconds before. And for example, you'd come across a busted open purse. Well, somebody had stolen that, on the surface or in the subway station, and then they ran into the tunnels with it, and they were kind of going through their goodie bag there, see what they got. And then they heard someone walking towards them, and they just took off. So I never got to meet them. But I did get to explore, a lot of the things that I read about in this book. But then, when we came back to the platform, all grimy, hours later, we show up back at the same platform. Yeah. We were arrested because apparently we had been on camera the whole. There had been I saw a camera on the platform, but it was hanging at a cockeyed kind of angle. I thought, it's not working. So I didn't think it was recording us or what, but it was. And so they were waiting there right for us as we came up. And it's like, oh, okay.
They thought they had captured some of the mole people.
They probably knew right away, that we weren't, probably didn't look at all like the mole people look. And then there's the railroad tunnels. Those hook in with the New York City subways. And there are some railroad tunnels around here. I mean, there's plenty of them in the Midwest. And those are definitely used by, there's a whole valley in St. Paul in the capital state that runs quite close to the Capitol building. It's called the Trout Brook Valley because it used to be a surface stream. They put it underground in a culvert and it flows today like it did 100 years ago, except underground. And there are all kinds of railroad tunnels running through this valley. And that is like the most gigantic homeless encampment in the city, and they go down there and live on the banks where this stream had been, and they walk through the railroad tunnels. And so that's kind of like a little bit of the Big Apple right here in town. A lot of the other uses I can forms a nice segue into Mushroom Valley. Like I said, this sandstone, this pure white sandstone, was ideal for providing pure silica for making glass. And so that was the first stage. It went in there and they carved out all these artificial, at that stage, they were mines. They were silica mines. And so you can use it to make glass. You can also use it in foundry work to form, like if you're pouring cast iron to form the mold, you can build that mold out of sand. Another place you'd want to use it is in mortar. For cements, concrete, and so on. And so in that sense, these old silica diggings were eventually taken over by the mushroom growers. And so what had been what I call Silicon Valley,
Silica Valley.
Yeah. I thought, hey, man, this is really good. This is Silicon Valley. We had a Silicon Valley at one time, but very different than the one in California. That's when it became Mushroom Valley. And so Mushroom Valley is just another word for like several mile stretch of the Mississippi River Gorge where it runs through the cities here. And that's where the mushroom growers took over these silica diggings and started growing mushrooms in there. And it didn't just happen, you know, it wasn't just some epiphany or something. There were actually people, immigrants who came from Paris who had seen mushrooms grown in the catacombs under the city of Paris that sort of said, oh, well, hey, we recognize this. You know, this is a good place to grow mushrooms. And the catacombs of Paris, of course, you know, most people think of it as a cemetery because you go take the catacombs tour in Paris and you see a lot of bones. But the catacombs originally were just underground rock quarries. So if you go to Notre Dame Cathedral and, you know, a lot of these medieval buildings, you know, where did all that stone come from? Well, it came from a quarry, obviously. But it didn't come from a surface quarry. It came from just pretty much right below the city of Paris, and they brought all that up. It's just hard to imagine all the labor involved, you know, the hand labor involved in this kind of thing. So mushrooms had been grown in the catacombs under Paris since about 1650. And that's that's like the first time that, you know, mushrooms have been grown, you know, are known in Oriental cuisine for, you know, hundreds of years BC. I mean, it's a really ancient tradition. But in the Western tradition, you know, like mushrooms are eaten in Greece and, you know, in the Roman Empire. But those were mostly just, you know, those were mushrooms that were collected in meadows and they weren't actually cultivated. It wasn't until we get to about 1650, is according to my sources, when actual cultivation of the button mushroom, the Agaricus bisporus, began. And that brings up a big question because, of course, you know, the French who are, you know, famously so, you know, just they're so insistent on their cuisine. Why in the world did they pick one of the most tasteless mushrooms? I mean, some of these mushrooms, like, I love them. I love them anyways, but, you know, like, you know, some of the mushrooms cultivated in the Orient, I mean, and here now, I mean, in the West now, they have a real flavor. They're real flavorful, have all kinds of flavors. And, whoa, now we get this bland kind of button mushroom. It's,
for mushroom lovers and folks that love foraging, it's the number one question. How do we end up with Agaricus bisporus? And it's usually how we overcome mycophobia or people, I don't like mushrooms. Like, no, you don't like white button mushrooms, but there are other mushrooms out there for you. But that is an amazing piece of history. And all of this tells a story. You know, I asked about artificial cave systems and there's this idea of creative and adaptive reuse, which was probably happening with natural cave systems as we were inhabiting them and using them for burial. And then we make our own cave systems for a utilitarian purpose like mining that then gets repurposed into burial or growing mushrooms or cultivating something else. So it's just amazing to think of that history of caves as kind of this almost like a natural resource, a natural habitation space for humans throughout time, is really interesting to think about. And yeah, I appreciate you giving the roots of the start there of these Mushroom Valley caves in St. Paul, Minnesota, hearkening back to the catacombs in Paris, France. So, you know, when we talk about those Mushroom Valley caves in St. Paul, I mean, when are we talking? When do you think that they first started being used for this purpose?
The claims are that it began in 1880 and terminated about 1980. So for reasons I'll talk about, but very different reasons. But that was the so-called mushroom century. It was a direct technology transfer, if you will, from Paris to here, if the stories are accurate. Now, my research in city directories and so on, the mushroom growers don't show up until about the year 1900. And so people are claiming maybe 1880 is when they started, you know, people arrived here and maybe it just wasn't official enough to actually be in the city directory. And somebody knows something I don't. It's like, you know, but definitely by the year 1900, and it was chiefly an immigrant thing. It was not only the French, we have such names as, all kinds of French names like Mouchneau, Lambert, Foussard. These are like the names of the mushroom caves looking little newspaper clippings. You'll read these names, but it was other immigrant groups also. Italians are big into mushrooms. We had the Basiglia family here, and they were the big Italian family. Then we had, Germans, the Lehmans. It was chiefly a sort of thing associated with immigrants. And so mushrooms were by far and away the largest repurposing of these like abandoned silica mines. But there were a few other uses. Sometimes if someone stopped in the 1930s, for example, something new, also fungus related, came on the scene. And that was the ripening of blue cheese in Canada, the Penicillium roqueforti, that wonderful blue mold. That began in the 1930s, and it's still, that hung around for a long time, up until the 1960s in some places, around here. Some of these caves also, when they went out of use as mushrooms, so they went through these phases. So it was a silica mine, and then a mushroom cave, and then sometimes if it didn't become a cheese cave or cheese ripening cave, then it could become a nightclub cave. And we had
a nightclub cave.
Spectacular example in the 1930s, Mystic Caverns, which you can still get into if you know where to go. And that's a favorite haunt of the urban explorers around here. This place, if you actually like one cave I could be transported to back into to see back in the day, it would have been Mystic Caverns, because it opened right after Prohibition, and so they could legally drink alcohol in there and so on. They had a brass, this cave was huge as a former mushroom, it went for hundreds of feet. They had a brass rail bar in there. They had, you've heard of smoke and mirrors. They had a smoke and mirror set up in there. They were doing magic tricks. I guess one of the associates of Thurston, the magician, did some tricks in this cave or featured in this cave. And they could make it look with these mirrors like they're, like somebody was floating above the heads of the audience, if they get the lighting just right. And also it was a place associated with kind of somewhat scandalous things, such as the first fan dancers in the area, with like nude fan dancers, like, woo, where do I go to see that around here? Well, you go down to the caves, now you go down to Mystic Caverns down there. And I've seen the advertisements for this place. The sort of billboard, the announcement for it was a gigantic neon skull and crossbones on the bluff above. I would have loved to have seen this place. It was so like, this is a very wonderful repurposing of a mushroom cave, down the line. But,
I love that image of people in this 1930s nightclub and just the marketing of it. I mean, the whole scene, I'm sure, was incredible. And one of my questions was, can we use caves like this for mushrooms? Maybe the question is, should we be using caves like this that still exist for nightclubs? I did have a question about these mushroom farmers, because it sounds kind of clandestine. And even you have immigrants kind of going underground and growing mushrooms. Was this, though, very integrated into kind of the business landscape there in St. Paul? Was it, I guess you could say, kind of all above ground, and this was like a well-known big part of their industry?
Oh, yeah, it was. It was exquisitely dependent on the businesses of the time. I mean, it was, and most one of the reasons that the Mushroom Cave, Mushroom Valley, eventually, there were several reasons it died off, but one of the important reasons it flourished back in the, at the time it did, was because of all the, this was before automobiles, you had all this horse manure on the streets. Now, what do you do with this? I mean, you know, here are some weird people, some weird immigrant people who don't speak English, living down in a river valley, and they'll take all this horse dung off the streets for nothing. They seem to want this stuff. What do they want it for? Well, this is the substratum for mushroom growth. And when the automobile came in and the horses retreated from the city. We still have horses around here. I mean, you can find horses around New York City. So, but the horse belt is still like way out now. It's way out in the rural areas around the cities. You have to go miles to encounter before you encounter horses around here. And that's where when Mushroom Valley, it didn't so much die off completely as it moved away. It moved to like above ground cinder block facility, like the warehouses you're describing, off where the horses were. It's kind of a lot of times it's a marginal sort of business. And if you have to pay a lot of money to import this, you know, horse manure from somewhere else, all of a sudden it's not so attractive. It's not very attractive when, as opposed to having just, you know, the free materials that you need to use. There were a lot of, occasionally I'll hear people around here talk about, they'll read about the Mushroom Valley frequently, you know, in one of my books, and they'll say, you know, at a book signing, I'll say, well, geez, you know, we ought to like reopen, we ought to start, you know, start a mushroom cave here again and stuff.
That's
and
right.
I just point out there are a lot of things that are, you know, you'd have to get just right down to make the whole thing work. And like, you know, I point out that you realize that those people had free manure, you know, back then. So they had, you know, a lot of the materials that they needed to grow the mushrooms is just free of charge. Another thing I don't think people think about is when you read interviews with these mushroom growers, this was a very labor intensive activity. Nowadays, there are some facilities that grow mushrooms on conveyor belts. And then, you know, when time comes to harvest them, you push a button and, whoosh, you know, they all fly off the conveyor belt into a bin and you're done. It wasn't that way. These had to be hand-picked and you had to pick them at the right time. And, you know, and it was a very labor-intensive business. And a lot of people were... I just not willing to do that kind of work. And with immigrants, especially the immigrants were in back in the old country, they were inured to heavy labor frequently in whatever country they came from. You get into the 1970s, which is when Mushroom Valley really started dying off. You know, you ask a kid in the 1970s, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? Oh, I want to be an astronaut or a fireman. You want to be a mushroom? No. What do you do? You got to sit there, you know, with these carts of dung and, you know, all this stink, the cave like stunk to high heaven and moving dung around, picking up horse dung and then going and picking these. Who wants to do that? And so the immigrants themselves said, our children just don't want to continue with this business. You know, it's like, forget it. You know, we're going to go off and do something else. We're going to go to college or whatever.
Well, and for a lot of modern mushroom farms, that is still the case. The incredible amount of labor required, including, you know, for the big mushroom farms, they have folks that live on site there on the farm and just needs to be 24/7 attention to these organisms because you need to constantly be picking them. They have a short shelf life and you constantly be processing them. You can see that. You know, and being in a cave doesn't naturally present an advantage on that front. You can see a lot of the reasons that already work against a mushroom farm or a lot of the things that already make it a challenge to start a mushroom farm. If you take away that readily available substrate, suddenly there's not a lot of benefits or not a lot of influences or not a lot of advantages that you have.
Yeah, and it gets, and there's, there's lots of details that these people, these farmers, lots of like artisanal secrets that they knew that would have to be relearned. For example, to something so, so absolutely basic as having a ventilation hole way back in the, when you go into these mushroom, these abandoned mushroom caves, and they're all abandoned nowadays, you'll frequently find like a little hole through the ceiling. It's like, oh, I overlooked that. It is so incredibly important to do that, because if the concentration of carbon dioxide from disorganic activity gets above 5%, the growth of the mushroom just stops. And, you know, yeah. How would you even, know something like that unless you just through sad experience, going through whether you should have doors on your cave or not, all those kinds of, there's all kinds of little secrets here and there that would have to be relearned to make these caves, profitable.
When we heard about the reuse to nightclubs in the 1930s, where do these caves stand today? Are they just uninhabited and more of kind of a tourist and research thing? Or where do the mushroom, what has become of Mushroom Valley?
Yeah, so that's, as I mentioned, in the 1970s, it was kind of getting, it was getting ever more marginal to operate a mushroom cave, but they were still there, some of them going full blast into the 1970s. What really killed it off was that the county came along and said that they want to build a, heck, you're right, got this wonderful riverfront property here, and what's these stinking holes in the ground? And we want to make a park here. And that was the birth of Lilydale Regional Park, but also the death of a lot of these mushroom growers just moved out to the outer suburbs. And there's a lot of market gardening out there now, just that kind of thing of other things in the market gardening sphere. But that's all moved away from the cities. And so, but this had a dire and unintended consequence that they had never thought of. And that's when, okay, we started with Silicon Valley in 18, I talked about that when they were mining the silicon, and it became Mushroom Valley, for a century. And then after that, from 1980s to the present, it's become Death Valley, in the sense that once these caves were abandoned and no one was watching them and there were no doors to close the entrance, well, now it becomes a great place for teenagers to, go play around in. And those are the caves that I was speaking of. My brothers used to go in. And I was forbidden to go into to explore. And they had a great amount of fun in them. And I would say, 99% of the time, there's no harm. It's just every great once in a while, something will happen. There'll be a collapse. Or someone is climbing up a shaft and then they slip and fall to their death or break their back. Or somebody will start a fire and it'll be over. Caves fill up with smoke so fast. So we've had a number of deaths, but it all started in the 1980s. It was right after the mushroom growers were kicked out. And it's like, duh. I mean, teenagers didn't explore these caves when they were active businesses. You didn't have that problem. And so then what they did, the city got the bright idea to like push wood and stuff into these caves, like from demolished house. So sometimes like when they demolish houses in this park to be, then they just push the wood and they go, well, now think about that. Oh, someone, hey, well, it's kind of cold in this cave. Let's start a fire. We got all this wood here. So these carbon monoxide deaths and smoke inhalation deaths started at that time. I don't think it was not well thought out. So these caves are beloved of the urban explorers around here. You can go in if you know where to go. You can go check out Mystic Caverns, even this 1930s night. You can go down in there today. You won't find a relic of it at all. You won't find the old chandeliers that were said to be in there, the brass rail bar, all the mirrors of that. You won't find any relic of the nightclub era in there is in terms of an artifact or anything like that. But you do see, you know, you do see the rooms and where the stage had been and all that. And it's just kind of and I think there are YouTube videos that, you know, out there's so many, everyone goes in there, makes a separate YouTube video. And yeah, I'm just point the finger at myself too, because I made one about Becker Sand and Mushroom Company Cave, which was the largest mushroom cave in Minnesota. And that was such an interesting name. That's what its name was in the city directories, the Becker Sand and Mushroom Company Cave. You think, what a strange pairing. Why would you have sand and mushroom? What's that? But as I've just explained, it was a company that mined out the sand.
Yeah.
And then the mushrooms came in right behind the shovels, and they planted mushrooms like right where they had just dug. And so those are the two products of this cave. And it was at its absolute peak in the 1920s, and it was sealed in the 1960s, but there is kind of a squiggly way to get in there if you know the way. And so I just made a YouTube video about that, and you can see the condition it's in now. I mean, it was in the 1920s, it was compared to a medieval cathedral. I mean, it's huge. I mean, 30-foot ceilings, immensely long passages. And then what they tried to do was they took a bulldozer and tried to fill it up with all the debris from this bridge they knocked down nearby. And it was, in a sense, it was a disaster because that debris settles over time and leaving a space on the top. So your cave is still there. Basically, it's just kind of at the top of the debris pile now. But now you've got all this wood, you've got all this flammable material in there. You got rubber tires, you got wood, you got all these sharp, nails and all kinds of things. And so it's like they kind of made the problem worse. And so other places like the city of Chippewa Falls in Wisconsin, they had brewing caves, and what they did is they made them into parks. And so they didn't push the flammable debris in there and then yell at people when they died in there. They left it completely open and put, it's lighted and there's trails in there. And I haven't heard of any problem coming from that.
And I was thinking, these guys are managing or fighting against a human impulse as old as we are to go in and explore caves and be in caves and use them somehow. And I'm just thinking, there's a lot of conversations now about really municipal natural infrastructure. And more we're realizing that conservation is so important to all of our even artificial ecosystems, protecting natural infrastructure like rivers, like trees. And I wonder if caves should be added to that mix as their potentiality for something. I mean, is that something that comes up as kind of conservation efforts about caves?
Huge, because these are artificial caves, but the thing about them is that's where most of our bats are. Mm. When the city comes along and really tries to really seal a cave well, that can wipe out a bat hibernaculum. And, these bats are part of our ecosystem. They destroy, mosquitoes. And so there's been discussion about that issue that, a lot of times that's destroying bat habitat there is one example of it's just been pretty morbid here talking about Death Valley, and that there has been a shining example of reuse. There were two nightclub caves. I mentioned one, Mystic Caverns. That was the most glamorous one. The other one was Wabasha, or it was called Castle Royal. And it was sort of a rival, and it was in a cave, an old mushroom cave several miles away, and opened up right after Mystic Caverns as a competitor. And that's still open today as what they call Wabasha Street Caves, and they give tours, and they have their own website. It's wabashastreetcaves.com, something like that. This is an interesting mushroom cave because what they did is at one time they turned it into a restaurant. And so it went from being a mushroom cave to being a restaurant. And if you're growing mushrooms and you have a restaurant, what do you think is going to be the number one thing on the menu It's going to be much.
I wonder. So,
so if you want like a mushroom Swiss burger, man, we got you covered there.
You know, mushrooms, and we might have even grown the cheese. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it was, but the interesting thing in this cave is that they've cut out the doorways in the form, you know, like that, like the typical kind of mushroom has that keyhole shape. That's the shape of like, if there's like connecting passages inside that cave, they're in the shape of a mushroom. It's really, I mean, they really did it up nicely in Art Deco style, and they have their, they run the so-called St. Paul gangster tours out of there. You know, Al Capone is associated with Chicago, and it's St. Paul was supposed to be a place they went when they were after like a major crime. They would need to lay low for a while. They could come
go
there.
Into the mushroom caves.
Yeah, no, seriously. That's what I, you know, there's no documentation of it, but it's possible that they did that and patronized this place, this restaurant and nightclub back then. It's very possible. And so they give the St. Paul gangster tours out of there, one set of gangster tours. And, you know, they've repurposed the cave very well. You know, they rent it out for weddings as space for weddings. And you know, they bring bands in there. But that's apart from really miscellaneous storage of the junkyard people along that stretch of road, apart from that, wow, it's just not being utilized.
Yeah, well, and as I focused on anthropocentric uses of the cave, like nightclubs and ground, but I appreciate you broadening that perspective to, of course, think about these as habitats,
yep,
as havens, potentially a biodiversity of bats. I'm thinking of glowworms in New Zealand with their luciferase, you know, going nuts. And then even mold species, you know, I've just recently been reading a book by Keith Seifert all about yeasts and mold and rusts and these organisms that have taken us through time. And he has a whole area dedicated to cheese mold and how obviously different caves have different populations of these molds and how it can lead to different types of cheese. So who knows what type of species are still yet to be discovered. You talked about caves being unexplored. That also is potentially frontiers of unknown biodiversity as well.
It is indeed. There's a researcher at the University of Minnesota, Christine Salomon, who is sampling the soils in these abandoned artificial caves to see if she can work up any kind of antidote to the white nose syndrome disease that has been in bats has just been wiping out our bat population. I mean, just in the U.S. generally. And so I've taken her on some cave trips and she'll collect samples, you know, trying to find a mold or something in there. And I don't know. I haven't seen her latest papers. She might be someone you'd want to talk to at some time. She's really into molds and finding, you know, and I believe it's the Department of Drug Design at the University of Minnesota specifically, because I don't think it's their mycology department at all. So that's there are other fungi in these mushroom caves that kind of take over when the mushroom business ended. Some of these abandoned mushroom caves, one of the strangest fungi I've seen in them, I believe it must be a wood rotting fungus of some sort, because when they grow mushrooms, they're frequently grown in trays, as you know. You know, when you go in a mushroom, you know, see, it looks like library shelves as far as the eye can see, these wooden trays, and then they, you know, stacked up with the mushrooms. And then when they abandon these, when the mushroom caves are abandoned, frequently they're just left. They just leave everything in place. And what happens is these wooden shelves, then they become, you know, the wood rotting fungi, the saprophytes take over. And I have seen the walls of some of these abandoned mushroom caves covered by these I don't know what to describe it as, like this rippling octopus kind of as the mycelium goes up the wall and is kind of like spreading out in all directions looking for more wood. And I've kind of traced it back, and it seems to start at like a piece of wood. So I'm assuming it's a wood rotting fungus, basically like kind of reaching out tentacles for looking for more wood to colonize. But it creates these big fan-shaped, it's almost like, you know, look at a petri dish, but kind of like on the wall, and with this big spreading kind of pattern. It's the fascinating fungus that takes over once the mushrooms are gone. Ironically enough, you know, for when I talk about the people who explore these caves nowadays, like the teenagers will go in there and have fun and stuff, and the thing is, they will, I don't know that they probably don't realize that these had been mushroom caves at one time, but they will spray paint mushrooms on the wall, and invariably they spray paint Amanita mushroom. It's the polka dot one, because that's the one that's colorful, and the one that the caterpillar sat on smoking in Alice in Wonderland. So, I mean, you're going to pay. I've never gone into a mushroom cave and seen, a beautiful spray painting of Agaricus bisporus on the wall. Never. It's always Amanita. And it's like, hey, dude, they did not grow Amanita in this cave. You'd be glad they didn't. You'd be dead.
That's hilarious. And that was one of my big questions is, you know, the future of cave research. And I think you've laid out a pretty big element of that, which is exploring biodiversity present in these cave systems. But, you know, as someone who has so much experience in this field, any other notes or bits and pieces about the future of exploring caves? I mean, will technologies like LIDAR and ground penetrating radar make a difference? What do you see in the future of exploring cave systems?
Well, the future is now. What is some of the things? I attended a talk about the use of LIDAR in caves. And LIDAR, of course, it's like radar, but with light.
With
lasers. Technology. Yeah. And you know, the old way of surveying a cave was you'd go through there, you know, with, a tape and compass. And, you know, you go with it, you have somebody sit there, you know, and then with the light source, and you go and, you know, the compass and kind of pull a tape measure out. And a very, you know, very involved sort of activity to get that right. And now what they're doing is they're automating this LIDAR mapping, where, you know, you just carry the LIDAR unit through the cave, and the thing is, you know, with tape and compass, you don't pick up any wall details. You have to draw that in. That's a separate thing. With LIDAR, it picks all that up automatically. But here's the coolest thing. So after you've gone through this, you just basically, you know, walk through this cave, this LIDAR unit, then you plug it into the computer, and if you have a three-dimensional printer, you can print the cave off in three dimensions, the passages, you know, what it looks like. And so, like, if you get to immensely complicated, like, sulfuric acid caves, like they have down in, you know, like Carlsbad, Lechuguilla, something like that, man, you get so many vertical shots and stuff, it's hard to know. But now imagine, like, you can print this off on a printer, and you got, like, a three-dimensional model of your cave. Whereas, you know, with the old tape and compass day, you know, you just, like, you'd sit there with a pencil and draw this out on it's like, forget that. I mean, this is like, you know, I got a model of the cave. I just printed out a model, a three-dimensional model of my cave, you know, from this LIDAR unit. So in terms of biodiversity, that's also gone high tech. You know, the old way had been, you know, you go into a cave, and you set little pit traps. Sometimes, you know, they tell you to bait it with blue cheese. That's the thing. It's like, I remember doing that. Like, you dig a little pit there, and then you got some extra blue cheese, put that in there. Nowadays, what they can do, especially if you have a system, this is mostly for aquatic, for wet caves, mm-hmm. That have like streams flowing through them. what you can do is if you can sample the water at the exit of the cave, which is the spring, and then you can run it through and enhance the DNA. And then even though you don't have a sample of the organism, because you can tell from the DNA fragments there, you know, using polymerase and all those enzymes and so on, then sequencing, it's like, oh, here are the telltale signs of all these different organisms that are in this cave. Even though you don't have it in your hand, you've got the signal of it that it's in that cave. And that's like immensely economical. It's much better than going through there like with a tumbler and getting a glass bottle and getting water samples and stuff like that. So those are some things that are really helping to perceiving like whole new kingdoms, if we use that sort of colonial terminologies, whole new kingdoms of bacteria and non-bacteria and so on.
I mean, that's fascinating. And of course, that kind of high throughput advanced DNA technology is changing mycology completely too. You can take a scoop of soil and suddenly, yes, find your whole new worlds of organisms hidden in there. So I'm not surprised, but it's fascinating to hear that laid out. And I guess for you, what is in your future? Do we have any more books on the horizon? Any caves on the list that you need to explore? What's kind of your future plans?
Well, I was hoping they'd get around to finding that largest cave in Minnesota, but
of course,
so I could have a look at that. But in terms of mushroom caves, I would like to at some point write the definitive article that sums up the history of these caves. Because it doesn't exist right now. There's nothing. It's all like little in the fugitive literature. Like a newspaper clipping here, a rumor there, and it kind of put it all together with what I've seen, and just sort of write the definitive history article on those mushroom caves. I finished several books, and I'm kind of leery of getting into another one because the last one was a real ordeal, lasting 6 years. So it was kind of like I was glad to be done with it. I do have an idea for a book, but I haven't started on it yet or pitched it to anyone.
Well, fascinating. I'm always impressed with anyone who writes a book, much less several, and then decides to do it again. It seems like such an incredible journey to go on.
It is, and the ironic thing is that almost every single book I've written, I would not, if I were to do over again, would not write it because of something that happened during the course of it. For example, my first book that I published, Iowa Underground, A Guide to the Caves of the Hawkeye State, it was an immense amount of work and it got published. And I didn't learn until after I'd written the book that the way the contract was written, the publisher, if let's just say somebody else had put out another Iowa book right before mine, just by happen, so we didn't know that was coming, came right out of the blue. You could just say, boom, we're not publishing yours. And it's like, I just spent all this time driving through Iowa, 10,000 miles driving through Iowa, and you're not going to publish it was like that with every book. There was something like that. My last volume, this textbook, Caves and Carcy Upper Midwest, it was a contributed volume. I was an editor and I just wrote a few of the chapters. And I got to tell you something, people will promise you, I'll write a chapter on something. You try to get it from them as a whole nother, that's a whole different thing. And it took me 6 years. It was emotionally draining experience. And it wasn't writing a book. That was the easy part. It was getting other people to write and send in their contribution, which they had promised me. And you'd be surprised how people can vanish on you all of a sudden. Academic can suddenly not be in the department at all when you call their secretary. It's just a mystery. For one reason after another, it's like every book I've written has been some major thing in it like that. It's like, I wouldn't do that again.
Well, that's one of the benefits of, you know, being naive at the start of something is, well, I'll jump into this. And then you don't know what you're getting into, thankfully. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it. And yeah. I know a lot of folks, naturalists like yourself, who explored the natural world, you know, there's part of that, hey, I'd rather be out exploring than writing a book about it. So I laud you for the discipline to put those books together. And where can people find your work? Where is the best place to go for people to find more information about you and your work?
Yeah, sort of the hub is my website that's drgregbrick.com. And so that's drgregbrick.com. And I also have a YouTube channel, and that's just under my name, Greg Brick. And then I have a Facebook group, and that's Minnesota Caves is the name of it. That's one word, Minnesota Caves. And that has, you know, it has like north of 500 members on there. So I just, you know, if there's some news in town, if somebody gets, like, for example, you know, someone recently rappelled into a very deep shaft in Minneapolis, and I guess forgot that the other part of it is that you have to be able to ascend your rope. And so they, like, I guess they text, you know, called the fire department from the bottom and said, hey, I'm down here at the bottom of a deep pit. And so that got into the news, you know, post things like that.
I thought maybe even new nightclub openings. You never know, but I definitely highly recommend people check out your website, check out your work. There's links to the articles, the books. And I mean, we've touched on bits and pieces, but this is such a massive topic. And really fascinating. I mean, I think part of our brains are wired to be really kind of curious about caves and these underground structures and ecosystems. And so I definitely highly encourage people to go and read more about your work. And I'll kind of wind things up with three closing questions, and I've switched them up a bit just given your expertise and background. But the first one, I always keep the same, but the first one is a mainstay, is what is a mushroom or fungus that you love and why? This can be a cave, an exotic cave mold, or an amanita of some kind, but a mushroom or fungus that you love and why?
Yeah, well, obviously, for reasons, the agarist bispore's a little too bland, so I would get booed if I mentioned that one. So I actually find yeast fascinating, you know, not only from the, you know, and you're gonna say, oh, okay, the beer and wine, well, no, but for this little sac or this microscopic sac or, you know, globule, it has an immense literature and a long history. There's a guy called James Barnett who's written an entire series of, and they're all available online, these articles about the history of yeast, published in a journal called Yeast. And I was really taken with the lengthy history of this seemingly, you know, simple organism. And all of the interesting things it's done and what it took in the 1800s to finally figure out what it was doing and what it was capable of doing. So this very simple ascomycete, I believe that's it. I took
dead on
cryptogamic botany. There's actually a course at the U of M is cryptogamic botany. I don't, nowadays they probably don't call it that, but I took that in the early 1990s, and that's when I learned about my basidiomycetes and you know, all the other ones. But so that's just my favorite historically. And
there are few organisms better studied, I think, than Saccharomyces cerevisiae, brewers and bakers yeast. And yeah, just to think the massive impact on human societies that this tiny organism has had. I recently had someone on who said, you know, at any one time on the planet Earth, there are more yeast cells alive than there are stars in our galaxy. Ooh, okay. You know, because we're cultivating so many of these for so many purposes. So a fantastic answer. And then you've had a unique relationship with areas of the planet that don't get explored. So what is this relationship you've developed with the realms under the earth? What has that given to you? How has it shaped you? How has it shaped you? Maybe how it's defined you? You know, what has that relationship given to you?
Initially, it gave me a research project back when I was an undergraduate. very interesting place to access the urban geology without, that basically no one else was willing to check out to look at. But beyond that, I think it is, I've gotten a little typecasted in that sense in writing about caves and so on, because now it's assumed that, I'm slithering through sewers 24/7, and I haven't done that sort of work in years since before my book Subterranean Twin Cities was published. But it, people do kind of regard it's, well, oh, there he is. There's the urban explorer, the urban cave explorer. And so it's kind of like that's, and sometimes occasionally people do recognize me on the street. I mean, I'm not like Kim Kardashian, but people do know me by name sometimes on the, oh, hey, there you are. I read your book or whatever. And so I've given lectures, a lot of talks around town. I've given lectures to the Minnesota Mycological Society, and some are linked on my website, about cave related fungi, just like, what we're talking about here. So that's in that sense, it's, that's how it's kind of shape me. It's given me a research program and to some extent a reputation for better or worse.
Getting a purpose and helping you find your place in our society, what you contribute, those are massive things for essentially a void to be able to provide. So it does sound like a very fruitful,
that's an interesting
relationship.
Yeah, that's an interesting paradox. So
yeah, I think I went very deep without intending to there. And I just have to know, as a follow-up to that, has any of your family been influenced by your love of caves? Have you pulled family members down into the earth or anything like that? Or do they all think that's our crazy cave guy?
My brothers were the ones initially when I was growing up who explored caves and told me about it later. They're not about to go in. When they grew up, it just grew out of that phase. And that's just when I was getting into it. My wife, when we were courting, she claimed to like caves, and we went in a lot of caves. After we were married, she could drop the act. And so now it's difficult. She's game. But it has to be a nice, clean, lighted cave with walkways. I used to take her in some quite offensive rad holes back in the day, and she cheerfully put up with it, but not anymore.
What a trooper.
Yeah, she was. I got to tell you.
I love that. And then the last question, just what are some books you've been reading maybe that have been inspiring you? I'm always putting together new books to read, so just some books you've been enjoying or inspiring you recently.
Oh, inspiring me. Yeah, I don't read too much of that. I do a lot of academic research for my for articles I write, sure. And so I get a lot of I read a lot of heavy academic books, just earlier this year I read The Principles of Geology in 3 volumes by Charles Lyell. It's like the classic by the father of geology. Everyone talks about it, but very, very few geologists have actually read it. And I read it from cover to cover in 3 volumes. So that's kind of like, that's mostly the kind of reading that I do. As far as inspirational reading, I've always loved Thoreau and his one of his quotes. I love epigraphs. Like a little quotation to start at the start of a chapter. Yeah. And most of my books where I can do it, where it's a format that allows it, I'll put a little quotation. And sometimes it is a quotation by Thoreau, like the one that starts my Iowa Underground book. And it goes something like, everyone when they were young would always love the appearance of shelving rocks or the appearance of the entrance of a cave. And I thought, that's, wow, that nails it, boy. And that was like, you know, of all the, you know, of everything I read in Thoreau, that was like the one cave thing that really nailed it. But I just love his metaphors, and I try to incorporate those kinds of metaphors in my writing. So he's been a huge inspiration over the years.
Can't go wrong with Thoreau. Nope, and when you talk about big academic tomes on geology, you know, there's a joke in there about heavy reading somewhere. But Dr. Brick, thank you so much for coming on the Mushroom Hour and sharing with us so much of your discipline that I am very nascent in. I'm excited to learn more about this and sharing this amazing story of Mushroom Valley and being so gracious to kind of explicate things and giving great stories to us about your work. It's really been a pleasure to speak with you. So thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me and allowing me to share some of these, a lot of these details, you know, I don't really get to talk about with ordinary people. So, because they're not too interested in mushrooms. So it was